Hi, and welcome to a video for Drop 9 of SharePoint Guidance V2. This is Erwin van der Valk.
And Francis Chung.
From Patterns & Practices. This is the agenda for today. And these are all the subjects that we covered during our Drop 9. First, we're going to look at the trusted facade pattern that we implemented. We're also going to look later at the refactorings we did to our repositories. We're going to look at some cleanup that we implemented to allow you to remove orphaned SP web config modifications. And lastly, we're going to look at the Safe Script Manager support for update panels.
So we'll get all into that detail a little bit later on. But let's go and talk about some of the other things we accomplished during iteration 9.
Okay. We supplied some guidance on how to use host header names instead of the port numbers that we use.
For example, in our current guidance, if you hit localhost, actually machine name, port 9002, that will direct you to the extranet extended website of the Contoso web. Instead of using the machine name port 9002, you can use a host header name, which is more common.
In that case, you can use extranet.contoso.com or something that you more closely resembles your own organization.
Exactly. We provided that guidance in the setup and installation doc, and may need some IT pro help here and there, but that should guide you into how to set up that host header name.
Another thing that we did, which we're not going to show but just talk about, is that we removed most of our .NET 3.5 usages. We got some feedback from our advisors from the community that a lot of people who are using SharePoint might not be that familiar with .NET 3.5. And even though it has a lot of really handy features that make the code shorter and maybe a bit more readable, it can also block the adoption of our guidance. So we decided to remove most of the usages from it.
For example, link statements, extension methods, what was the last one? I think lambda expressions. For the most part, that's all gone from the code base, except for the unit tests. The unit tests use the TypeMox AAA Arrange Assert Act API, which uses lambda expressions. But for the most part, in the code base, in the main Contoso code base, you will not see lambda expressions and other .NET 3.5 usages.
And the last thing we addressed is we did a bunch of cleanups in our code. So we ran fxcop and started cleaning up the messages that come from fxcop. And we also looked at XML comments. So you'll see more and more XML comments in this iteration and in the coming iterations.
We took a look at the trusted facade as an option for getting rid of the fake SSO provider. The SSO provider allowed us to resolve what partner or backend credential to use for a certain user. For example, if I were to log in as a user of a fictitious, let's say, partner one, then when I access the backend system, I want to actually access the backend system as partner one. And the SSO provider will allow you to do that. That's what it's built for. The reason why we created a custom SSO provider is because we're using forms-based authentication on the front end, and the out-of-the-box MOS SSO does not provide support for a non-Windows credential coming on the thread. So it doesn't support FBA credentials on the front end. The downside is that the SSO provider, we needed to store the credentials, for example, the partner ID and the partner password for these backend credentials.
And storing passwords is really something that you have to really take into a lot of consideration to do that, because there's a lot of attacks that can happen against an SSO provider. And we didn't want to take on the complexity of building a really secure SSO provider. That would make it would be almost a project in itself. So what we did initially was build a fake SSO provider that stored the passwords in clear text. But then the feedback from our advisors and from some of our customers was that even though we call it fake and it's very clear that this is not a real SSO provider, somebody might still use it in production. So we wanted to get rid of the SSO provider and build something that's secure but wouldn't store passwords in clear text.
So that's why we took a look at the trusted facade pattern, which would allow us to get around that.
This diagram shows what the trusted facade pattern looks like. So a user connects to a system. The system typically is located in the DMZ, or demilitarized zone of your network. And he authenticates to that service or to that application using its own credentials. So in this case, user John logs on to the system. And the system itself has an authentication store or some way to verify that the password that the user provided is correct. Now, if the trusted facade wants to make a call to a backend service on behalf of that user, the backend service, of course, could itself revalidate the authentication information. But to do that, it needs to know all the passwords again. So what the trusted facade pattern implies is that the backend service will trust any call that's made from the trusted system, and it will trust it in such a way that if the trusted facade says this user is John, then it will trust that it actually is John. It won't revalidate the username and password to make sure that that user is really who he says it is. Now, in order to do that, of course, you have to make sure that the backend service cannot be reached by the user directly, but only through the trusted facade. Now, in our situation, SharePoint is our trusted facade, because a user connects to SharePoint. He authenticates either using FBA, so form-based authentication, or using Windows authentication. And then SharePoint will make a call to a backend service, our LOB services in our case, using the name of the partner that SharePoint has determined for that particular user. And the backend service will not validate if the use, if the DMZ, the system in the DMZ has actually forwarded the right username and password, because it trusts our SharePoint installation to provide the correct information. Okay, so let's look at how we implemented the trusted facade pattern. First, let's look at our services. So we have a couple of WCF services in the contoso.lob.services project, and we had to change something in the web.config to allow the trusted facade to work. So down here in the service configuration, we removed this piece because this was the original method that would validate the username and password. But what we had to add was the fact that we are sending the username over the transport channel, and also we have to, of course, secure that channel, and we're using HTTP transport. And one thing that's still the same, that's specified down here, is the fact that even though we're not validating the username and password combination, we still need to set the username password validation mode to custom, so this is still the same, and we still have to specify a class that could potentially do username and password validation. Now, if we have a look at that class, the LOB name password validator, you'll see that this is effectively a no-op, because what we are doing is we're forwarding the partner name as username, and we're not forwarding a partner at all, a password at all. So we don't have to validate that. And then there's another class which is already here, the security helper, which will get the client username, or in this case, so the partner name, from the claim set that's forwarded to the WCF service.
So Erwin, how do we ensure that the service is not called outside of the trusted facade?
Okay, now that's pretty much a network security and IT pro action, because first of all, you have to make sure that the outside world can never directly access these services. And then what you should do is make sure that the user account that SharePoint runs under is the only account that has access to this service. And you can configure that, for example, in IIS. And there are other ways of configuring this, but that's pretty much a network security action and not really a developer consideration.
Okay, thanks.
So now on the client, we didn't need the SSO provider anymore. So we removed the SSO, the fake SSO project from the solution. And what we also did is we had to make some changes to the WCF configuration. And one thing to make that a bit easier is we put all the WCF configuration for the client in its own XML. So here you see that XML. And You see that we have the same configuration here for the client. So we're using username of transport, Windows Stream Security, and we're using HTTP transport to connect to it. And then we're going to go into the repositories a bit later, but in the repositories is where we are calling the services and where we also have to provide the username of the partner. Now, where you can see that is, for example, in the pricing client. So in the constructor, yes. So what you're seeing here is that we're creating the proxy to access the service. And what we have to do is add the as username, we're going to use the partner name. So you'll see that here that we're setting the username.username to the partner site directory.getCurrentPartnerID. So this method will get the current partner ID from the context, and we'll set it onto the WCF service. And we're not setting a password, so now in this case, whenever a user uses the pricing repository to retrieve a price, he will get the price for his partner.
Okay, so let's take a look at what we did to refactor the repositories. One thing we did was we took all the service references and we put them all into one project. If you take a look at the contoso.lbservices.client, that's really where we centralize all of our services. Also, we moved the service proxies, we moved them internal such that if you really want to get access to these services, you need to use the repositories. The repositories then use the proxy classes in order to make the calls to the services.
One thing we had to change to do that is we could no longer use the types that were generated from the service proxies. But it is some work to translate the types that come from the proxies to something that we want to use inside our application. But the nice thing about this is that if the service will change over time, we don't necessarily have to change the implementation of our application. So we're shielding our application from changes to the service.
And on a final note, we want to make sure that we only get access to the repositories through the service locator. We don't want our consumer code to actually instantiate a repository itself, because we believe this is really a service that should be provided to that consumer, and that's provided through the service locator.
That also makes that the consumers of these repositories can easily be unit tested, because you can swap them out for mock objects.
Exactly. So again, if you take a look at Contoso LLP Services client, you'll see all of the proxy classes, the repositories, as well as the SP web config modifications that are necessary to allow your application to see those services.
Okay, so let's look at what we refactored for our repositories. The first thing we did when we refactored those was to put all the proxies that were generated for the WCF services into the same project. Now, the reason why this is a good idea is even though it's very easy to add a service reference to a project, adding such a reference will create, as you can see here, a whole bunch of classes and proxies. Now, you could, if you have several projects that are accessing the same service, you could of course just add several references to it. But you end up with several generated proxies. And first of all, if you have to change the service contract, then you have to regenerate all those proxies, which can be a bit annoying. But what's more important is that you can see that it not only creates the proxy, but it also creates the objects that are transferred across the proxy. Now, if you have some code that runs against such a generated proxy object, and it won't work against a proxy object that's generated in another project. So consolidating those into a single library can make a lot of sense. Now, what we also did was we made these proxies internal. Now, the reason why we made them internal is if the proxy would have to change because fields are added or something changed in the security model, or you wanted to do them asynchronously instead of synchronous, or some other reason, then you don't want to have your application logic to be impacted very much by those changes. If you own both the client and the server part of these references, this might not be a big deal. But if you are consuming web services from a third party, for instance, or if there are several clients who are using the web services, and it can be really handy to encapsulate the access to the repositories through the web services in a repository. Now, of course, using WCF requires a lot of XML configuration. What we did, so we placed all this XML configuration into a single XML file. And in our web application receiver, as you can see here, what we're doing is we're getting that file from the resources, and we're using that to create a SP modification class. So this makes it a lot easier to edit and to update this file if you want to. Another thing that we did was to, like I mentioned before, to encapsulate the proxies in a repository. Now, an example of that would be the pricing repository. Now, you can see the pricing repository will internally have a pricing client, which is of course a generated proxy, but the outside doesn't see that. You can also see that we're adding some credentials here, which we mentioned before. And in some of the methods, for example, in the getPriceBySQ, what we will do is we will call the pricing client to get, for example, a price in this case. But since we generated the proxy internal, what we have to do is translate the object that we get back from the service into an object that can be used by the application. So let's look at how we are translating the object. It's very simple logic. Could be a bit tedious to write though. We're getting a price object here that is returned by the proxy, and what we're doing is we're translating that into an object that can be used by our application. So we're just copying, in our case, we're copying all the values. But if the proxy object changes, then it doesn't necessarily have to impact the price object that we have here. Last thing I wanted to show is how we are using the repositories. Because like we mentioned before, we are using the repositories through a service locator. This makes it a lot easier to unit test our consumers. So for example, if I go to a presenter that uses one of these repositories, for example, the product details presenter. Now this product details presenter will get, from the service locator, will get an iProduct catalog repository. And from that point on, it can use this repository to call methods on it. And internally, it will open up a web service proxy, do the web request, and close the proxy again. So this is if you follow this pattern, for unit testing, you can replace this catalog with a mock object, and you can very easily unit test it.
So we also did some work on cleaning up old SP web config modifications. Now, why are there old SP web config modifications? Well, one reason is that if you put code in your feature deactivation to remove the SP web config modification instances from a web app, well, what if somebody goes and removes the solution without deactivating all the features on all of the SP webs? In that case, your feature deactivation code will never get run. Also, if there is an exception in your feature activation code, your feature may get taken out without it fully being cleaned up. So there may be some old SP web config modifications lying around. What we recommend doing is we have some code. If you take a look at the Ajax support project in the feature receiver, in the feature deactivation code, you can see that we're actually trying to look and cycle through all of the SP web config modifications where the owner is myself, and then removing them as a prep or as additional cleanup code. We also considered that may be valuable in the feature activating. So before you add new ones, make sure to purge all the old ones too. So that's something we can do. But yeah, we remove based upon the owner field.
One place where we're showing how to get rid of orphaned SP web config modifications is in the Ajax feature. Now if I crack open the Ajax feature, you will see in the feature deactivating that there's a new method that's added here that's called cleanup web modifications. In there, what we're doing is iterating through all the web config modifications that are in the system, and if they match the owner, then we will added to a list of web config modifications to be deleted, and we will iterate through the list so that we're deleting them. Now this owner, as you can see above here, what we are using for it, you can use whatever you want for it, but what we are using for it is the name of the assembly. So in this case it's going to be microsoft.praxis.spg.ajax support, and we're using the same name for creating the web config modifications, as you can see here. And that's a very easy and straightforward way of cleaning up the web config modifications that might be orphaned by some mechanism.
So that was our recap of JobMap 9 work. Again, we concentrated mainly on refactoring. So we did a lot of code cleanup, looked at the FXCOP violations. We took a look at how we're using the repositories, and hopefully we've got a little bit closer to ship shape.
Yeah. Well, hope you liked what we did in Job 9, and hope you liked the guidance. Please check us out at codeblacks.com/spg. This was Aaron Vandervelde
and Francis Chung.
Bye-bye.